one day my phone rings, and it's a friend of mine who runs a company that has three full-time employees and a few part-time employees. And I knew that a few weeks earlier, he had just fielded an unexpected call, which was a bodyguard assignment for several days in Las Vegas. And I asked him, you know, how did all that go? And he said, yeah, it went pretty well. And I said, you know, well, who was the client? And he said, well, we're not supposed to say. I said, yeah, I get it. But he said, you know, the client was Bill Gates. So,
velkommen til ny episode av Fighter Mindset. I dag har jeg med meg en spennende gjest, nok en gang. Han vokste opp fattig, skral, svak, og hadde mye vold i oppveksten fra foreldre. Men han endte opp med å bli en fallskjermjeger i forsvaret, kommandør for SWAT. Han ble en konsulent for regjering når det kom til antiterror i USA. Han har vært livvakt for noe som heter Fortune 500 CEOs. Og han er jo en utrolig sterk mann. Har brutt mange rekorder, når det kom til Guinness World Records og Ripley's Believe It or Not. Han heter Mike Gillette. Han er en, jeg sier, mindboss. Han er rå på mindset og kan gjøre utrolige ting fordi han er sterk i sinnet og har sterk mindset. Gleder deg til det. Gå på Mike Gillette med LL og TT.com, MikeGillette.com, og sjekk ut hvem han er. Gleder deg til intervjuet. Ha en god helg og god påske. Welcome, Mike Gillette. It's great to have you here.
Great to be with you.
It's like I was thinking, like before we started, well, today I was like thinking, where did I hear about you? And I think it must have been when I was Googling some, maybe it was through one of my friends, John Rankin. He's been teaching some combatives in Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Maybe okay. It was him. I'm not quite sure because I think it has to be some years ago. I was Googling some mindsets, how to overcome, become stronger. And I had to be Googling your name, and then you came up and I downloaded this like, what's it called? Mindboss, some strategies, I think.
Okay.
Some PDF booklets. I don't remember, but I never think I went through it, actually. That's a shame. I've got to be honest with that. But like, I've been following your work and know what you've been doing in your story. And it's amazing.
Well, yeah. Appreciate that.
Yeah. So it would be great. I don't know how many Norwegians have heard about you. Like, I'm not quite sure about it.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I didn't really have a sense of the reach of the internet. I mean, intellectually, everyone says, you know, the internet is everywhere. But for a long time, I sort of labored under the idea that I think maybe a lot of people have that, well, the only people who are going to really resonate with me are people who are like me, you know, similar professional backgrounds, maybe similar generationally, you know, as far as age, similar parts of the world, because in other countries, how could they possibly, find any sort of commonality? And it wasn't until I started experiencing a little bit of success with some of my products on the internet that I started seeing all of the places that people lived who were buying my products. Mm. And I mean, it was probably 6 or so years ago when I stopped counting, because I used to keep a tally of every country, you know, so United States, Canada, the UK, you know, the obvious places. But once it got past 50, I stopped paying attention. Yeah, I mean, countries in Africa. I mean, so there was no sort of geographical barriers. I mean, people are interested in what they're interested in, and they're going to look for what they want to learn about. And it's very humbling when, you know, in the same way that you have a podcast that, that reaches all over the world, and you had guests from a variety of different countries. And that is, you know, at a time culturally when we're constantly being reminded of how different we all are and how separate we all are and how, you know, these groups aren't getting along and things like that. You know, I take a lot of comfort in sort of the unifying potential of things like the internet. I mean, yeah, we can we can look at anything as good and bad, but you know, here we are having this conversation today, and who knows who we're going to be able to reach with the words that we share. So it's I have, like you, no idea how many people in Norway might know, but maybe we'll get a couple more of them today.
Yeah, awesome. Like I think like with Facebook before, like you could add whoever you wanted. And I've added you. I don't remember. I could always get back to it. Maybe, I don't know, years back. I don't know. Because I had like a period where I was struggling. Like we all have periods different. Like we can just call it by different name. Like we all have our struggles. Like it might be the same, but with a different name. Or So I was very into like listening to, I was Googling this warrior. I came across, what's it called? Greg Swanson from Warrior Mind Coaching. I think that's his name. Yeah, I heard, listened to some different podcasts when it comes to mindset. And then I think I must have been good. Yeah, as I said, when we started, I was Googling your name. And then I've been reading your story, like from being a paratrooper. You could tell more about that and like how you ended up bodyguarding, like being a bodyguard for the, what's it called, Fortune 500,
Fortune 50.
we don't have this in Norway. Being a SWAT leader and team leader and all the cool stuff that guys like. And and recently, the past years, I've been delving more into my own personal development. I've been reading books that have changed me. I continue to explore, and then I created this podcast a year, like April last year, and I reached 40 episodes already. So I was like, yesterday was my 40th. Well, yeah, the 40th. So it continues to grow, and then
congratulations on the 40th episode. Thanks. That's an achievement.
So yeah, it's wonderful, like how to see how it's growing, and yeah. So it would be like, could you please, would you like to share a bit about the story? Like,
briefly professional background, that kind of a thing.
Yeah. Like briefly,
who you always have to say briefly when the guy you're talking to is old and has been around a while, because there's a lot of stuff, but it's not all interesting.
Yeah. I'm certain that a lot of people will recognize like similarities, like, but as I said, like different stories, different lives, but there's a lot of like things that are connected together with each other.
Yeah. Well, the reason some people will pay attention to what I have to say with respect to, you know, if we're talking about, you know, self-defense and you know, tactics and martial arts combatives in that particular world is because I have been able to sort of traverse a variety of professions in which, you know, those types of skills and abilities are an important part. So that started when I was quite young. I entered the military service, and I wasn't intending on staying there. That was going to be an interim stop for me. I had wanted to become a police officer, and I'd actually tried, but I found that at age 19, nobody was going to hire a dumb kid. So I had plenty of enthusiasm, but no life experience at that point. So it became known to me that the military had some incentives for money for advanced school and college, that sort of thing. So that sounded interesting to me. And I was just at a point in my life where the Army also sounded interesting to me. So I joined. And while I was in the military, things went very, very well. It was just sort of, you know, the right time in my life, the right environment, and, you know, the right type of encouragement. And it, you know, a lot of people don't mesh with that world. Mm-hmm. You know, they yeah. find, you know, too rigid. And I mean, because the military is such a large thing, you can't quantify it to any one, you know, experience. So some people have amazing experiences. Some people are very frustrated while they're in it. I was just very fortunate. Mm-hmm. And nice. The types of people I was around were very encouraging to me. And that sort of led me to really explore a facet of my personality that I think persists to this day, which is just I'm really interested in testing myself and pushing and you know, exploring limits, and then hopefully, you know, trying to, you know, erase those and redraw new ones. And that was kind of what my life was like during that period. And I found that it was not a world that I wanted to leave. So when it came time to wrap up my enlistment time, I was looking at a few different options for staying in. I could either, you know, re-enlist what I was doing, because at this point I was taking college classes and I was on track to become an officer. And all that means outside of the military is it's the difference between being a line employee and management. Being an officer is simply management. You know, it's management with like cool new stuff on your uniform. And that made the most sense to me. So I had an opportunity to exit the service, but still remain under the umbrella of the service, receive a monthly stipend, have the service pay for my civilian schooling. And then I would come back in as an officer. And at the time, that's really what I wanted my career to be. It felt very right to me. And it was just something that I enjoyed. So that was the plan for at least one full semester of college. And at the end of my first semester, and this was in Tucson, Arizona, University of Arizona, right before final exams were to start the next day, I took an invitation from a friend to go on a rock climbing outing. And the short version of that day is things went badly. I was set up with some equipment I was unfamiliar with, and jumped off a railroad bridge to rappel down into the canyon as we climbed back out. Anyway, the equipment was never connected correctly, and I smashed into the canyon floor, broke my back, my ankles, and so forth. And from that point on, any sense of an active, you know, physical life was just completely out of the question. I was wrecked. You know, my orthopedic surgeon, who had been an orthopedic surgeon in the Army and was acutely familiar with the rigors of that world, told me, you're not going to jump out of any more airplanes. You're not going to run anymore. You'll walk. I mean, you're lucky to be alive. You know, those things that people tell you when you're young and you don't feel lucky and you don't really have, you don't have mature coping skills and all of these things. I was just really angry and really more scared because I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And at this point, you know, I was married, we had a baby, and I needed to figure some things out. So the next really 4.5 years were a mostly unsuccessful attempt to physically rehabilitate myself to the degree that I could at least maybe look at being a cop. The military was like as I understood it, was just a super rigorous lifestyle, but maybe being a cop would be sort of like one step down, which is not to denigrate the law enforcement profession. That's just sort of how I saw it at the time. I was young and didn't know much. And I was unable to stop myself from trying to pursue that life, even though I was in pain all of the time. I was in no physical shape that would have indicated I'd ever have success, you know, trying to re-enter that world, but I couldn't stop myself from trying to re-enter that world. And, you know, inexplicably, after some years had passed, I got to the point where I was able to reasonably consider it. And I started applying and testing at several law enforcement agencies. And then, you know, by the time I was hired by one, physically speaking, I was looking pretty good. And things just continued to go very well for me physically. The real secret of that whole 4.5 year rehabilitation process is most of the time I was so scared of being broken and weak, I kept trying to you know, fast track myself, you know, towards progress. I never really gave myself a chance to heal and recover. And I was broken seriously enough that I really needed that time. So once I tried a more moderate approach, the body was able to kind of, you know, keep up with my expectations. But, you know, I was, you know, too young and freaked out to have been entrusted with the responsibility of my own rehabilitation in those days. Somebody else should have been in charge.
Yeah.
But of course, if they had been, I wouldn't have paid attention anyway. So there you go. But that was, this was 1989. So that was really my entree into the world of law enforcement. And there was a duality to my time in law enforcement. There was me, the police officer, and, you know, I enjoyed that work immensely. I found it very satisfying. Of course, you know, it's frustrating and all of those other things too. And it's full of tragedy and it'll rip your guts out, but that's kind of what you sign on for. You know, it's, you don't do certain jobs because they're easy, but because they will allow you to experience things on a very deep level. And because you are willing to put yourself in a situation where you're the person who needs to be accountable in that one critical moment. And maybe that will be a moment that, you know, proves, you know, very eventful, you know, in your little corner of the world. So I very much wanted to be that guy. I really wanted to be that guy to test myself, to see if I was worthy of being in that guy. So I had that part of my professional life. I was the cop, you know, on the street doing cop stuff. But for whatever reason, very early in my police career, I had been sent to a training school, which certified me as an instructor. Now, in this case, it was in the area of physical fitness, which I was, you know, a rabid enthusiast of at the time. And I think I was sent because no one else in my agency really wanted to go. I don't think it's because I was special, because I was so new that all I was doing was just annoying people because I was excited, and you know how new excited people can be.
Yeah.
And kind of like this, only just younger. So I went to that school, and it wasn't that the school itself was, you know, an amazing collection of other students and curriculum. It was the idea of being entrusted with information, of taking on the responsibility of being, you know, the resource for important information that I would then be charged with imparting, you know, to my fellow officers. That's what spoke to me. And it turned out I was pretty good at training. So I was teaching in the police academy setting. And then that led me to the next training course and the next training course. And I realized fairly soon that even though I felt like I was a pretty competent police officer, that's not true. I felt like I was the best, but that's common to all young police officers. You know, we all think we're cool, but, as much as I enjoyed that work and it was very meaningful, I really felt as though my destiny was in this training world. I didn't know what to make of that because there were very few actual jobs that involved doing nothing but that. But I figured if I just compile the world's scariest resume, things will just magically work out. So that's how I approached it. I started to attend training courses that I was paying for, that I was using my own vacation time to attend because there was no reason for my department to send me to some of these. I was just very interested in the material. So I was in law enforcement for a period of 12 years. By the time I left law enforcement, my sort of growing trainer resume had taken me to both coasts of the United States. Now, concurrent with all of that, I was a very avid student of the martial arts. And I was, because I lived in the middle of the United States, no place special where there wasn't really anything particularly interesting happening in the world of martial arts, I was traveling a lot to train with famous martial arts artists. So, pardon me. If I'm losing my voice this early on, it means I've been talking a lot.
Yeah.
I hope it's been worth it. So I was training with people who in that, you know, sort of time frame were pretty well known. And So I had sort of an expanding sphere of influence in the world of police and military training, and simultaneously an expanding sphere of influence within the world of martial arts training, not really under my own brand, but I was becoming an indispensable assistant to someone else who was growing pretty well known in those days, a guy named W. Hawk Hockheim, who had books out. He was he had a lot of Filipino martial arts credentials from some very serious, you know, he was the only person that had black belts from both Ernesto Preysas and Remy Preysas, because those brothers didn't speak at the time. Intense rivalry. But yeah. I was really enamored with the Filipino martial arts. Beautiful. And so I started traveling a lot with Hawk, and you know, that started to open some doors for me as well. So I left law enforcement in 2001. At that time, I had more instructor credentials in use of force topics, that's sort of that broad umbrella term, than anyone else in the United States, which probably means anybody. And that is when I made the transition to training full time. I became the director of training at the National Law Enforcement Security Institute. Oh. And I had only been on the job a couple of months before 9/11 happened. And 9/11, ironically, had a big impact on my professional trajectory, which is, it's still to this day, almost 20 years later, it's kind of a troubling notion, because the work that I did post 9/11 just really kind of escalated my visibility within the training community. So I ended up doing more work with the airline industry than anyone else.
Yeah, which I think I recall that.
Which is astonishing, because I had no specific aviation security experience prior to that. But I had trained tens of thousands of people in intervening in dangerous situations, you know, behavior assessment, all of these other things. So there was relevant experience, but it wasn't industry specific. So the fact that that happened was pretty amazing. And I was competing against people who were famous, you know, famous as trainers, not famous to normal people, but people that you would know of. And in one case, one of the people that I was competing against at United Airlines was somebody I had been certified by years earlier, a guy that I literally was in awe of to that day. So it was a really strange sort of experience. Yeah. But at the same time, if you feel you're qualified to do something, you know, you're probably qualified to do something.
Yeah.
So
certainly
that was a formative period. And then that led to a particular training project that for a long period of time, no one could even talk about, couldn't say who the client was, couldn't say what the purpose of it was, but it was a number of years ago, and it had to do with the Disney company. Now, what a lot of people didn't know is that during the scouting phase of the 9/11 attack, there were other targets considered, but those targets were discarded as possibilities because they were just too logistically complex. They wanted to crash a plane into various targets in Las Vegas, for example, but that would have required so much flying, you know, over the continental United States that just wasn't feasible. And the amount of time that would pass precluded it. Another place that they wanted to hit was Cinderella's Castle in Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida. Now, this was something we didn't know until U.S. troops started going into Afghanistan about 6 weeks after the initial attack and looking at intelligence documents and computers that they were finding in caves. And needless to say, when Disney found out about this, they were concerned.
Yeah.
So that led to an interesting period of time when and this sort of is relevant in the context of, you know, what is the answer? I mean, you talk to a lot of very famous martial artists, you train in the martial arts. So you understand that sometimes the best answer to a horrible situation is a horrible answer.
Yeah.
And and if you're not of that world, if you're not sort of that frame of awareness, that doesn't seem like that's ever going to be correct.
Yeah.
You know, there is a there's a large segment of society, doesn't matter what part of the world, that will say things like, you know, violence doesn't solve anything. And they believe that in their heart, because in a perfect world, that would be true. But in this imperfect world, the world that we actually live in, violence is how a lot of problems get solved.
Sadly, it's
the reality in which we live. So that means that even if you don't like it, it's helpful for you to have an answer for it. So now if you think about the Disney company and what comes to mind when you think about going to Disneyland, any of those Disney parks around the world, it's happiness, it's fun, it's magic. Once you go into one of those parks, it's like the real world just kind of disappears, and they work very hard at creating that impression, and they're very good at that. So how can you take that sort of corporate mentality and find a way to smoothly reconcile it to the realities of a post 9/11 world? Well, you don't, because they don't smoothly, you know, nestle up together. It's an awkward relationship, but sadly, it was a relationship that had to come into existence. So, what that led to was the development of a program that I wrote, and then myself and a small team of instructors then, you know, took to the Disney parks. In essence, we were teaching people how to spot potential terrorist activity before it happens. And so that would involve doing all kinds of you know, practice drills within the park while it was open for business,
which that's interesting.
was a very scary thought to the executive level. Because what if something goes wrong? What if it just looks like it's a terrorist event, but it's not really? It was just training, but no one's going to be able to know. You know, all of these ideas start, you know, swimming through your head, and they're all very concerning. So the fact that it happened was kind of an amazing thing. And Disney invested heavily. They hired a whole bunch of people at their different parks whose sole function was to dress like tourists, behave like tourists, and look for potential problems. They spent a fortune on that just to keep their park safe. You know, it was very commendable, but it was not a technology-based solution. It was human-based. It was humans who were trained to spot other types of human behavior, and that was sort of a pivotal project, because there's this term again, Fortune 50. The Disney company is a Fortune 50 company. They are one of the 50 largest companies in the world. And, you know, so it was a significant thing to be entrusted with doing. It was a significant thing to have successfully accomplished. And that led to sort of a slew of other sort of you know, training projects, surveillance detection projects, threat assessments, and so forth. And because of the world in which I was running in at this point, I had friends who I would sometimes help out. You know, like you've probably helped out at martial arts seminars. Maybe somebody comes to town and you're one of the guys that sort of, you know, helps teach and helps answer questions and so forth. Okay. So I had relationships like that with different people who ran different little, you know, small training companies. Well, one day my phone rings, and it's a friend of mine who runs a company that has 3 full-time employees and a few part-time employees. And I knew that a few weeks earlier, he had just fielded an unexpected call, which was a bodyguard assignment for several days in Las Vegas. And and I asked him, you know, how did all that go? And he said, yeah, it went pretty well. And I said, you know, well, who was the client? And he said, well, we're not supposed to say. I said, yeah, I get it. But he said, you know, the client was Bill Gates. So a couple of weeks go by and he calls me at my office. At this point, I'm a faculty member at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, which had a entity at the time called the Institute for Security Studies, which sounds, you know, very academic. And it was, in my particular division, was the Department of Operational Readiness Assessments and Training. It's like just this really long title. You can barely fit it on a business card. But basically, that was who I was working for when I did the Disney project. That's who I was working for when I did a variety of other projects. It was just sort of like this catch-all. As a lot of attention was going to what was being called Homeland Security in the United States, there weren't a lot of people that were sort of addressing those needs at the time. And I happened to be, you know, hired by one of these entities. Anyway, my friend calls and he said, "What are you doing this weekend?" I said, "Why?" He said, "You want to make some, a little extra money." I figured which usually meant that he was running a training course.
Yeah.
And he had an agreement with a nearby Air Force base. So we did a lot of firearms training and so forth out there. And you always need extra help because their clients were primarily military units. Hmm. So I figured I was maybe agreeing to that. And he said, "No, we've got a security detail this weekend." I said, "Really?" I said, I said, "Who with?" He said, "Well, I can't say." I said, "Is it that same guy?" He said, "Yeah." So my first bodyguard assignment was with the richest man in the world. That's where I started in that world, completely because of training relationships. So I never had any intent to go into that world. I wouldn't have known how to. I didn't know anybody in that world. And it was just... because the usual West Coast provider for this particular client was busy that weekend, that we got the call. And the reason that we got the call is the company that had the contract for Microsoft at the time, we created their training program for them. So they figured that, we might be trustworthy enough to handle the rigors of that particular assignment. And that led to a 5-year stretch. Many more assignments for that client, many more assignments for everyone else in upper management at Microsoft, clients for the CEO of Berkshire Hathaway, the CEO of, it's a tech company, you might've heard of it, it's called Google. So most of our client base came from the tech industry, mostly on the West Coast, basically everything from San Francisco to Seattle, we were doing a lot of that work. And not a lot of, celebrities and things like that. A little bit of that happened, but that was, again, it's just because of relationships. People know you, they call you, and so on. So that was 5 years of that. And it was really those 5 years of living in that world, which is basically, there's a big planet. That's the client. And then there are, like Jupiter, the planet has multiple moons.
Yeah.
Those moons are bodyguards and personal assistants and housekeepers. Like there's all of these moons, these satellites that orbit the client, and the client's orbit is so strong that you're stuck in that orbit as long as you're in that world, in that line of work. Yeah. And it's interesting work and you have a lot of very interesting experiences, but it's after a time it becomes claustrophobic because there's no room for anything else.
Yeah,
and I'm married, I have kids, and I was starting to not see people that, I really want to spend time with, and you're not in charge of your schedule because so much of the business travel that these types of people have is fairly spontaneous, and plans are getting changed constantly, and sometimes they think they're going to go to London for a meeting, which means you have to send some people to London to set things up, and then, they're not going to do that. We had a client who on a Thursday would have three plans in mind. He was either going to stay home, which was in the Seattle area. He was going to go to the UK, or he was going to go on a photo safari to Africa. He hadn't decided, and it was Thursday. Now, see, when you have a certain amount of money, you can be very flexible with your decision making, which meant that, people were flying around the world only to get called on, they land and find out as soon as they land, now he's going to stay home. So you jump on another plane, you come back, and that's kind of your world. You have to be ready for anything. And, that's just the job. And it's, as I say, it's an interesting job, but it's all consuming. Mm. And I had reached a point in my life where I wanted to have a means to share all of the things that I'd learned, not just with more soldiers and not just with more, you know, cops and bodyguards, but with regular people. Yeah. Because if we go way, way back into the 90s, when I started attending all of these training courses, I was always struck by how much of the things I was learning were applicable to regular people. It's like, regular people should know this. This is like universal knowledge. These are life skills. Now, some of it was obviously completely irrelevant, but I was surprised at how much of it seemed to just connect in a way that if more people knew what I knew, more people would just march through life, you know, motivated and confident and sure of themselves, and would, you know, speak clearly, and you know, they would inspire confidence in others, and they would just, you know, you and I are talking a moment before we started recording, you know, the idea of being strong, you know, on the inside. More people would be able to sense what that was and experience it fully.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of what I was carrying around up here that I really wanted to find a way to sort of get out and share with the world. And I had reached a point with the bodyguard life that if I don't leave this now, I'm never going to leave it, because it's very comfortable, you know, well taken care of. Okay. I worked for an amazing company, and I worked alongside people who I consider, you know, far more skillful and knowledgeable than I. So all of that is appealing, and it can kind of keep you in a place because, A, it's comfortable and it's known, and you're being well taken care of. But at the same time, if I don't jump now, it's going to just get harder if I continue to wait. So yeah, I jumped, which was kind of a scary thing to do, maybe more so if you're my wife, because all there was the unknown. Well, how are you going to do this? What are we going to do about that? It's like, I'll figure it out. You know, and I had had enough successes that I had unreasonable confidence. And if I had a clearer picture of how difficult the first couple of years would be, I would not have had that unreasonable confidence, you know, because I needed that just to sort of keep moving forward. And, you know, and it took a little while to figure out how all of this was going to work together, because I was just throwing projects at the wall, you know, DVDs, eBooks, real books, workshops, and so forth. And when things went well, they went well. And when they didn't, I didn't necessarily know why. You know, because I wasn't coming from like a businessman's perspective. I hadn't built, you know, a cohesive business. I was just solving training problems as I perceived them. So it took a little while to kind of achieve some stability and coherence in terms of what it was that I was trying to share with the world.
And interesting.
That is one answer to one question. You just said, tell us a little bit about
briefly.
Yeah. I'm half hour later. So I think that means you only have 1.5 questions left.
It's so interesting. Like the transition, like how it started, like couldn't, like would I ever walk? Would I be able to do anything physical? Then suddenly doing all the amazing things. And yeah, I think I recall you posted some years ago on Facebook, you posted some clips from, you made this training course, VHS for the airline companies. I think you maybe posted, I don't remember, but I think
that
I recall.
Sounds like something I might've done.
Yeah, but I think I recall that you made these like training videos for the airline companies during the, well, post 9/11.
Yeah. Well, there was, worked with several airlines, and in each of those projects were a little bit different. Ultimately what happened is, the largest contract was with United, and that was a project that was scoped for about 22,000 end users, because they're a huge company. Yeah. And what happened is United in those days was so big and such an industry leader within the aviation realm that you know, they had a whole self-contained training division. So when I developed my program, I did it in conjunction with their training division. And those were the people that shot like all the videos and created the manuals and, you know, made everything, you know, sort of reproducible, you know, on a large scale. Yeah. And then when we started to roll out the training program, United invited the FAA to, you know, to come and see this amazing thing that we had done. At this point, the TSA didn't even exist yet, which is the Transportation Security Administration, which is, that's the agency that everybody complains about because they're in charge of fun things like, you know, security checkpoints in the United States. And everyone enjoys that so much.
Yes, beautiful.
But so this was pre-TSA. So this is, you know, still like early 2002. The FAA came, saw the training, and United was so magnanimous, they said, here, TSA, here is our program. Just, you know, take it and share it with the industry. And I thought to myself, hey, that's great. I'm glad that you like it so much. But I was kind of hoping that I was going to, you know, maybe market that to a couple of other airlines. That was sort of the end of my career as a vendor to the airline industry. Had a couple of contracts with a couple of major carriers, extremely interesting work. And I learned a tremendous amount, and you know, it was a big responsibility, and it was a very humbling time. Yeah. But once the FAA took over my program, you can now, if you were to get hired as a flight attendant in the United States, you could still go through the Mike Gillette training program because they offer it at regional training centers throughout the United States under the umbrella of the of now the TSA. So in terms of you know, having a legacy, it's a really big deal when I think about it. I'm glad it went as well as it did because it's still out there, you know. And if any part of it had not been, you know, adequate to the needs of the task, that would be plaguing me every day because it's still out there. Awesome. So that was you know, I've had an extraordinary amount of opportunities where it was just, you know, right person, right time, you know, right place with the right sort of message, I think, because there's an infinite amount of talent. And I had a very sort of strange experience when I was at United, and I'd been on the ground for a couple of weeks. As I was building the training program, I was at United, you know, for weeks at a time. And because it wasn't just developing, you know, you stand here, you do this, you say that types of things, we had to tailor everything to the specifics of the different aircraft in the fleet, which are, you know, size and shape differences. They're staffed differently. You know, large aircraft have more personnel, smaller aircraft, you know, there are some aircraft that are so small, there's one flight attendant. So their whole response model is necessarily going to be different than if you're on a, you know, 777 business class carrier flying overseas and you've got like 14 flight attendants, you know, it's just different stuff. So I spent a lot of time on the ground, you know, in the aircraft, talking to different layers of employees within that that world. And it was just a really it's strange in a sense because, you know, I would come to Chicago once a week and I would land at O'Hare Airport, you know, world's busiest airport. It's crazy, and it's also the headquarters of United Airlines. And when you get out of your aircraft and you walk down concourse and all you see are just United aircraft, as you're taxiing in, taxiing out, all you see are just United jets. They're everywhere. And, you know, having a sense of the scale of what that client was and, you know, the time that we were in those days, because, you know, the further we get from that date, the more abstract it all seems. But right afterwards, there was real immediate concern that more things were going to happen and they might potentially be even worse. I mean, there was just a lot of dread in those first few months and even those first couple of years after that. And being connected to that work was very profound, very humbling. And, you know, again, just, it was a lot to take in. So yeah. The strange experience I had is after I'd been on the ground for several weeks, I noticed in one of the offices of one of the training specialists that there were a couple of mail bags. So those look like those have been there for a while. You're not, you know, you can't just keep mail. I said, no, it's all United Mail. And I said, well, what is it? Those were all of the proposals we received after 9/11. I said, seriously? Like, so are you saying that my proposal is in there somewhere? She said, no, not yours, because we pulled yours out. You know, we pulled a few out, but those are the rest of them. So I said, may I? Because right after 9/11, I knew that there was going to be some people who did this work. Yeah. Never thought it was going to be me. Never thought about throwing my hat in the ring. I mean, it's not that I didn't believe I had relevant experience, but somebody way more famous than Mike Gillette is going to do that work. It's inevitable.
Yeah.
So here were, you know, all of the envelopes from all of those people. So I sat down and kind of scooped it out. It was about a pile of envelopes about this big. It wasn't that dramatic, but you know, easily over, I would say over 150 solicitations, many from people you and I have never heard of, never will hear of, but they had resumes. But then there were the ones from the people that you and I have heard of a lot. Mm. And that was the thing that really surprised me. Because if I had known who I was competing against, I'm not sure how I would have felt. I'm not sure if I would have, you know, been confident enough to say, yeah, I think I have an answer also. And I think my answer is also worthy of your consideration. So I think the lesson there is if you believe in yourself, believe in yourself. You know, there's always going to be reasons not to. And I had a small mailbag full of reasons that maybe I shouldn't have even been, you know, part of that process. Mm. But there I was, part of that process. So an interesting moment. And it was one of those things that obviously stays with me till this day. This is, you know, many years later. And I'm always mindful of the probably 20 or so minutes I spent in an office just, you know, going through the stack of mail that had been sent, you know, many months earlier, each one laying out a credible case for why they should be the person to assist this airline in responding to this challenge.
Interesting. Yeah. It's like amazing. Like that's what's fascinating. Like your approach to mindset, like how you can, what you just said now, like believe, if you're going to believe in yourself, believe in yourself. And that's when it comes to like that, you're sharing all these, like how you have so many experiences, how you can like share to regular people and like your approach to mindset. As I told you before, when it started, I've been following a bit of your work, but I didn't know all of this. And like, it's amazing. Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. I think what's important for people to understand is if you meet me now, and I've got this resume, and it's a bit unwieldy. You know, I've been around long enough that there's just a lot of stuff stacked up on top of each other, and it can create a particular impression. And I think the impression that it can create is not completely accurate. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it probably creates the impression of, you know, there was a guy who was really motivated. It's like, okay, yeah, fair. But there is a guy who, you know, punched all the right boxes or checked all the right boxes, you know, in becoming this person. It's like, not really. But Mike, you were in the military. Yeah, but I have worked with people who did way more amazing things, were members of way more amazing units. I mean, I was in the 82nd Airborne Division. I thought it was cool, but I was acutely aware that there were much cooler people in the same base, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, just down the street with Special Forces. Just down the street from them, Delta Force. Mm-hmm. You know, like you know, the supreme warriors of the modern military era. So if you stack all of them together, I'm way down here. I'm young. I think I'm cool, but I know what real coolness is, and it was not me. So I rubbed up against the military experience. It was amazingly beneficial for me, but I was still very clear on the hierarchy aspect of the military. Same thing with law enforcement. When I got hired as a cop, I mean, it was a glorious day. I was so grateful because I'd spent so many years trying to get myself back to a point where that was even a potential. But it was a small agency in the middle of no place special. There wasn't anything about that job that would suggest that this guy would go on to become anyone with a certain level of visibility within the training realm. Mm-hmm. Certainly those cops come from LA or New York or Chicago or something like that, or, you know, federal agencies like the US Marshals or the FBI mm-hmm. or the DEA. Now, I end up being the guy who has trained all of those units. And it's not because I'm a genius. It's just that early on, I realized, okay, I have an affinity for training. I really like it. I also think I'm good at it. I'm not the best at it. I'm new at it, but I'm interested in it enough to want to become better. So I did, and I chased that. And the reason that it started to make sense later on for me to do this thing or that thing is because I was so incredibly well prepared. Mm. And why was I prepared? Because I wanted to be. Mm. And I didn't wait for anyone to make it happen. Now, if you're a cop in Los Angeles or New York, your daily job is going to provide you with some amazing opportunities to improve. Mm. And your agency will probably send you to some very high level, very demanding, you know, training courses. Well, my agency would never do that because it wasn't considered relevant. If I wanted that, I had to find it. I had to take my own time and my own money and go and get it and then hope I could even get into it, which I did. And nobody understood it at the time. I understood. Mm. I was preparing myself. Mike, what are you preparing yourself for? I'm not sure exactly, but I know I'm going to be ready. Because when I said I wanted to get into training as a full-time vocation, if you would have asked me, well, what jobs are there? I don't know. And if yeah. you would have said, are there many? I don't think so. How likely are you to get one? I have no idea, mm-hmm. but I'll be prepared. Mm. So now yeah, you so. Can work and become prepared and things don't necessarily go the way that you would like. But if you're not prepared, I guarantee you that things won't go the way yeah. that you hope.
Yeah.
So there's so no true. Question. I was very, very lucky multiple times, but I was prepared when that luck came to me so that when those doors opened, I had something with me that would be of value, something that I could contribute. Yeah. So I think that is the difference between me and a lot of people who have had the perfect resume all the way through, because mm-hmm. I've worked side by side with some people who have, you know, Hollywood resumes. They're just, of course they're successful. I mean, just look at everything they've done. I had to chase my resume, you know, entry by entry, and eventually it paid off. And that is what allowed me to, you know, stand and work alongside people who, you know, I remain in awe of to this day.
Yeah. So it's like, as you say, like preparation, it's so important. And if you want to improve anything, or like, as you said, like, if you're working towards something, yeah, you have to prepare, and then like, then we'll, maybe the doors will open, maybe won't, but like still have to continue preparing. So that like, that's sort of your approach to mindset when it comes to achieving like this Mind Boss Academy that you're running. And what's the, like the keys of it, or like the purpose of it?
Well, for me, everything I do, you know, whether it's just, you know, it's a book or it's a product or it's an ongoing, endeavor, you know, like the Mind Boss Academy, is having a means to teach people what I know, because what I have managed to learn through this, you know, unconventional yeah. life that yeah. I've been able to live is just a number of skills that serve me well to this day, that serve me really in every facet of my life, not just, in terms of accomplishing what I want to accomplish on a professional basis. But, you know, these are the things that make me a better person. These are the things that make me a better husband, a better father, a better grandfather, you know, a better friend. Mm-hmm. And also to become the kind of, you know, father, friend, husband, et cetera, that people can come to depend on, can lean on if mm-hmm. necessary. Mm-hmm. I found very early in life that although it's very demanding to be in a service profession, you know, so you think about nurses and teachers and firefighters, you know, all of the people who work in the world in a way to be of service to the world.
Yeah.
And it's exhausting because part of that all or those jobs is giving of yourself in a very profound and very personal
yeah,
way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it takes much from you, but it gives, if you can see it, it gives back so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I left law enforcement, I missed that. I missed that means of being able to contribute. So that's part of what I hope to accomplish now. I hope to be able to, you know, provide something of value that genuinely helps people live in a way that they experience more satisfaction, more success, and in however they would care to define what success means for them.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of being successful is being able to live out your own definition of it. So even though the job description has changed over years, for me, I still feel as though I'm doing the same kinds of things. It's just through a different delivery system, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Like that's something like myself, I'm working on with, like, I've been serving in like whatever like means serving church wise, work wise.
Awesome.
And then like, so now I figure out like, it's time for me to contribute and give back. Yeah. Like I've always had this idea of helping those who have been where I've been, like to help those, like whoever they are. So for me, it's kids and youths are being bullied. So that's why I'm like creating an anti-bullying program, because we have it in Norway and like, but and some of them have been like recognized internationally, but still like, and then I started this, like, it's called Warrior Heart. It doesn't, because like a warrior, he's not a guy who's, he's not fighting, but he's a brave person. He's first of all, he has to protect himself and loved ones, but also the others. Like that's what it's all about. Like, and so
I love that.
I'm working that one, and like, it's so important to give back as well. Like, of course, you can serve, and then like, you get like you receive a lot, but you also have to give back. So like, that's what I'm working on. So, and I'm not gonna do it alone.
Yeah. Well, good. And you've got this podcast, you're building a community of like-minded people and providing a resource as well. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you.
Okay. Hey, Dag, I don't want to cut you off, but I'm going to have to dash off in a minute.
Yeah.
Is there something that I didn't manage to talk about already?
I was dying
to find out.
Yeah. I was like, you gave like a good of those lessons, like when it comes to like mindset, but like, I would have to get you back on another, like, I would love to have you back to talk about like more mindset wise and like strategies.
If your listeners, if you think they could handle that, then you know where to find me.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mike. It was like great to.
Well, it's my pleasure. Great to been tracking the podcast for a little while. Big fan of so many of the people that you've had on, and
Thank you.
Forward to the chance to finally meet you. And here we are. I feel like I've known you for a long time.
Same here. Like, yeah, it was like the doors opened. It's so amazing to see. Like, I got one friend who like, and his friends are like these. Yeah, doors are opening, and which has led me to creating the online program, like the anti-bullying program as well. Like, it's a part of, it's like a whole, so I feel like I've been preparing, like just waiting for the doors to open.
And like, there it is. Just like what we were talking about.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, good for you. Keep up the great work, Dag.
I will. Thank you, Mike. And same with you. Like, and we'll stay in touch. And all right. I'll post some of the like the links to your Mind Boss Academy in the show notes and share
all
it.
All right.
Okay.
Okay. Take care, my friend.
You too, my friend. Bye bye.